Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. We're going to continue on with our last three witnesses for the dedicated funding bill, and just want to say we appreciate their patience. Mr. Kelleher was on the list as well. So is Mr. McAfee here? Would you like to approach?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee, representing AFSCME Council 5. We're the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent a number of workers in agencies of concern to this body, such as Department of Natural Resources, the Minnesota Zoo. After a merger, we had back in 05, we also now have a number of folks in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Parks and Rec, etc. AFSCME Council's 5, our support of a constitutional amendment to dedicate funding for natural resources, will support that, provided that there is an increase in the sales tax, as some of the bills provide, and that the thus the funding is augmented rather than supplanting existing funding. I must state that without a sales tax increase to augment funding, we would oppose such an amendment. I will conclude with that and stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Do you know, Mr. McAfee, if AFSCME is perhaps discussing being involved with a potential ballot effort in any way?
At this point, we have engaged in no such discussions, Mr. Chairman. It's been our practice that as we go forward, once it's clear something's going to pass, you know, then we would consider that. But so far, we have not.
Other questions for the witness? Thank you, and thank you for your patience throughout these hearings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Kristen Beckman, SEIU. Not seeing Ms. Beckman. Gary Leaf, Sportsman for Change. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Gary Leaf. I'm with Sportsman for Change. Essentially, for the last 2 years, I worked pretty extensively with the Rally for Ducks, Wetlands, and Clean Water as a volunteer, one of the many volunteers, and then we formed a group called Sportsman for Change. Sportsman for Change would essentially ask the lawmakers to support what generally sportsmen perceive as a clean bill, and there's 5 of them that we see would meet the needs of sportsmen. Senator Chaudhry's bill, Senator Scogin's bill, Senator Saxhagen's bill, Senator Pariseau's bill, and Senator Engelbretson's bill. There's really, with dedicated funding, there's been really 3 major phases over the last 75 years that occurred with dedicated funding. First, I guess the Missouri phase, which started in 35. That was launched by 75 sportsmen. Dr. Aldo Leopold, J.N. Ding Darling, who designed the first federal duck stamp and is a noted political cartoonist, and also Nash Buckingham, who's a famous outdoors writer and has produced a number of books. The second phase is probably a term is a fraction. Second phase of the Outdoors Amendment movement is 3/16. And I've got a 3/16 button on reflecting that movement, and anybody that mentions 3/16, that's essentially a sportsman movement. That was characterized by Minnesota Twins Kent Herbeck, who was characterized by former retired Vikings head coach Bud Grant, and it was characterized by Irwin Jacobs. The third phase of this particular movement was the Rally for Ducks, Wetlands, and Clean Water, which first started in 2005. And what I've got is essentially one of the tools we used to market it at that time. And I think it's a...
Hello.
An important piece of it, because we basically brought, over the last 2 years, approximately 8,000 citizens from around Minnesota to attend this rally. A lot of the marketing was done by Carmichael Lynch Spahn, which received a state award for its efforts regarding that, and also a national award for the in this particular type of category. Cabela's was involved, Gander Mountain was involved. And ultimately, I brought another document that where this received national attention, where Budweiser was also involved in a contest for an award with regard to this. So it received extensive state and national attention. From that time, we used billboards, 2,500 posters were distributed around the state, numerous PSAs such that that. From that point forward, the rally, roughly April, from that time all the way up until February 13th, another campaign ensued, and that was to promote around the state Senator Saxhog's bill and Senator Sam's bill, which was 0.25% out of the existing sales tax at that time for clean water and game and fish habitat. And there was a lot of volunteers who worked throughout the state on that particular effort, small chapters, larger groups, whatever, and so on. That pursued up until we ran into around February 10th of 2006 and woke up on February 13th to find out that a wedding had occurred over the weekend, and it was a shotgun wedding, and that our bill had substantially changed and created somewhat of a marketing and PR publicity problem for us. The Sam's and Saxhog bill had been converted from 0.25% of existing sales tax to new taxes, and approximately $100 to $120 million of new partners, if you will, were added onto the bill for museums, parks, humanities, public broadcasting, and so on. And within 2 weeks right after that, I had two large meetings with sportsmen's independent groups, 150, maybe 100, and the reaction to that was not very positive. It has not been very positive. You may get some positive responses regarding some of the more organized sportsmen's groups, but we have a major problem on our hands with some sportsmen, and I've been told by some of them to come here and frankly tell you that if, after being sold for this on this basis over the last a full year, and people coming from all over the state. This was one of the largest rallies ever held at our state capitol. And for them now to see what's been happening to this bill over the last 8 to 10 years, a number of them have told me to tell this committee that they will not only vote against this bill, they will actively campaign against this bill. That's how fervent they feel about it. Right after the last session, we also did some protests at both the GOP convention, where we had 30 protesters, and the DFL convention. You probably saw us down there in Rochester. The GOP convention, there was 30 of us protesting there in Minneapolis. There was one protester against the war, and there was one protester for marriage. I'm not sure if they were for it or against it, whatever their problem was with it, with marriage. We've sent 20,000 emails or postcards over to the Capitol. I have a stack this big of ones from out of state. We had a bus from Iowa that came up to the first rally. We've sent letters. We've sent emails. We've encouraged people to phone call. We can't tell if, frankly, if people are trying to pass the bill or they're trying to find a new way to kill the bill. This morning I read in today's Star and Tribune that there was a major event here yesterday regarding global warming. And when I saw that, I thought I'm going to testify today about the most important conservation bill based on the Missouri model in the history of the state. And now I'm seeing that the global warming, Minnesota's going to lead the world in global warming, and we can't even take leadership to save the state. Earmarking for humanities and cultures, although highly important, and I understand that, creates a major division with sportsmen who are 1.5 million of them on the whole. We talked to about only one out of 100 supported a game friend. There's 60,000 sportsmen that attend the event. Only one out of 100. Taxes is not a major problem one way or another. They're roughly divided. My own personal views is that if you have $5 billion of economic activity, unless Minnesota has no taxes of any type, there's got to be some level of taxation generated in the state. U.S. Fish and Wildlife estimated in 2001 it was $180 million. It's probably closer to $200 million. Something along that line. But if it's a new tax, sportsmen will support it. If it's an old tax, what they won't support with a new tax, roughly, is rent seeking. Instead of, in good faith, the tax was increased. We thought it was going to be Senator Saxog's bill, Senator Sam's bill. We got something entirely different. It added a whole new list of partners. So if there's going to be a sales tax increase, we'd prefer that it would not. It'd be much more of a narrow bill of those five that I mentioned. Essentially, I guess I mean, one of the biggest economic problems you can see is in the Leech Lake area, where you had a how this relates is you had a decline in walleye fishing over 5 years, and the mayor of that town reported that it affected Walker so much. Approximately, I think it was 30. Small businesses went out of business on account of the decline in walleye fishing, and 20 resorts went out of business. Another area that I would compare this to, 4 billion, 50,000 jobs is the ethanol industry, which gets a lot of media attention. Everybody's excited about it. They generate about $1.72 billion in economic impact and 6,400 jobs, where we're at twice that and 50,000 jobs. ATVs and snowmobiles generate $1.2 billion, 20,000 jobs that are dispersed around the state. I guess I would say that we've seen a number of the partnerships that are conservation-related, so on and so forth, not come out against anything, but say what they support over the last number of years. I would say the Rally Coalition, Minnesota Outdoors Heritage Alliance, Campaign for Conservation, MEP, and so on. As I mentioned about, I would say that on the whole, the sportsmen we've talked to, and I've worked through roughly 20, participated in getting people to sign postcards, 20,000 of them around the state, and reading their comments and knowing what they're thinking, I don't see very strong support at all for inclusion from that group whatsoever. The main concern we have is getting it is putting it out on the ballot. If this went out to the ballot, based on history from 1900 to 2004, only 49% pass. It's not with the highest of margins that they do pass, and we think that sportsmen would be the significant influencer. At least that's what the marketers tell us. First round, because that's the main target group we can find. A lot of the other citizens we can't find. Who are they? They're not in isolated specific events where you can find them. Last year, we did attend a large meeting. I did, a number of people did, a couple hundred in the room, where it said that adding the arts, cultures, museums, and trails, and so on, public broadcasting, does not increase our support at the polls. It reduces it, at least at that time. Now, on February 12th, or before that, we never did receive any polling, any warning whatsoever about the shotgun marriage that occurred over that weekend. It was done. We got there on Monday, and that was going to be the proposal that we were going to be supporting. So I think some sportsmen have been asking, what polling exists from before February 12th that shows that if you add on all of these entities, that they actually increase our support at the polls? Lastly, and I guess this is the last point I've got, I just want to give one more example of what someone pretty famous said at that first rally.
session. Session. More important, what we do today and what we do tomorrow and what we do Monday and what we do next week is more important than any stadium they've ever built in this state. This is more important than that. And you can quote me on that.
Well, that, of course, was former Vikings head coach, retired Vikings head coach, Bud Grant, who is on the pages of Cabela's, is pretty well known in the sporting community, and there's a lot of them, you know, that are listening to what a lot of these influencers that I would call in the varying things. But it's going to be very hard for the groups, these members of these different groups, all the sporting groups, they're volunteer-driven at the local level. We attended a meeting recently where the organizers of one group, they meet every few weeks, organize their banquets and so on and stuff, and they get direction from their groups, but really they're not controlled by the groups. The other thing, I guess in the last piece that I would challenge the committee to consider is that the other day you had a testifier that presented to you hundreds of examples of conservation referendums that have passed, the bulk of them, the majority of them, hundreds of them. During the 20th century, there's been hundreds of them. I think the first one we see in Minnesota is in 1900, which was some type of reforestation act. That failed. Out of the hundreds of them that passed, in talking with people around the country, we can find no example in the United States, at least us, and we hope maybe the media will look into this, no example that we can find ever in U.S. history where you combine conservation, natural resources, and the outdoors, and combined it with arts, humanities, zoos, public broadcasting, and that whole list that's on there, and it passed. We don't know of any example, and I talked to a couple of experts. They'd never heard of such a bill or a measure. So, I mean, I don't know if that's absolutely correct, but we do know that it passed in Missouri, barely. It would not have passed in Minnesota, although it passed at 51%, and that's the best model in the state. So I guess the last challenge would be to find the polling data from February 12th or before of last year that show that, in fact, it does increase our chances at the polls. And second is to find any referendum example where you have a combination of natural resources and humanities. And what were the results and if it, in fact, passed at the polls? And that's basically all I have.
Okay. Questions for the witness? Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I put this up yesterday. I'm bringing it up again today. I'm all for what you want to do here, but I don't think we can do it unless we do raise some taxes. I don't know how we're going to take it out of the funds we already have, and I don't know what your opinion of that is. I like to hunt and fish and everything else, but the main thing is to get this passed. And I don't think the votes are going to be there if we don't have a tax increase. Now, the other side of that, and I respect the governor, he doesn't want any more taxes. So some way we got to get a combination here so that everybody is on the right board.
Mr. Leaf.
Senator Vickerman, I thought maybe you were going to present your veterans bill. My 86-year-old father was a World War II veteran, like that testimony that you've given a number of times, the best. He fought in North Africa and so on all the way to Birch's Garden. So he appreciated the veteran piece that you presented. I would say that sportsmen are split on taxes. We've got some on one extreme that feel that, you know, they're anti-tax. We've got some on the other extreme that feel it really needs to be our own tax. Remember that sportsmen have in the past, in the midst of the Great Depression, went to the federal government and said, with Ding Darling, a number of these people, imposed, self-taxed ourselves. So we're not afraid of taxes necessarily, and it would give more credibility to our trying to protect our part of the issue. So I don't think there'd be a major problem. Where the major problem on taxes will occur is if it goes beyond clean water, if it goes beyond game, fish, and wildlife habitat, and if it goes beyond, we think, parks.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Leaf, just for clarification, you may be the most You may have laid it out there to the point where I'm hearing you say your group would rather take nothing than be included with these other groups. And it may come down to that will be the choice. And when you go to the polls, is your group prepared to vote against it just because other groups are included?
I think it's quite the contrary. Our group, and the way we look at it, is the same way we looked at the rally. What we do is we say that the grassroots level is the most important. We don't intellectually come up with a doctrine or whatever and try to impose it on the people. Rather, we go out there and talk to enough sportsmen where we get uniform agreement. For example, on taxes, we get uniform agreement. I really don't know. The problem is with this is that we've created a grassroots movement. I gave an example the other day where we had a sportsman threaten a legislator physically over in the House last year as an example. I mean, I really can't tell you what they're going to do. But I do know there's some of them that are really upset about what's been going on. It's not just in the last 2 years. It's 10 years, 8 to 10 years. So, I mean, we're not going to... I'm not going to take a position. We're not going to take a position on anything. The sportsmen are going to take whatever position in. But for example, you've got some in your district that have been calling us. And they're probably going to have a meeting with you and find out where you stand on it and stuff like that. I can't tell them what to do. I really can't. I'm not sure if anybody can. But some of them have gotten pretty upset.
Further Thank questions you. For the witness? Anything else? If not, thank you, Mr. Leaf.
Thank you.
Next will be David Kelleher, Historical Society. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Kelleher. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you for the opportunity to make some brief remarks to the committee on this subject. As this proposal has moved through the legislative process in recent years, some have asked us why history should be included in this proposal. In addition to the contribution to the quality of life that most of the other proponents have cited, I would cite two additional reasons why history ought to be included in this. For over 40 years, Minnesota statutes have defined historic and cultural resources as part of the natural resources continuum. Historic resources, like natural resources, are non-renewable. Once they're gone, they're gone. Two major parts of Minnesota statutes, the Minnesota Outdoor Recreation Act and the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, both include cultural resources and historic resources as part of their jurisdiction. Many historic projects over the years since the 1963 Minnesota Outdoor Recreation Commission have been included in LCMR funding. In this way, historic and cultural resources are similar to the outdoors and natural features that are contained in the bill. Secondly, I would mention that just as outdoor and environmental causes have pointed to a lack of stability in their funding, in recent years, historic projects and causes have also had some instability and have had severe cuts in budget flows. I won't go into detail on that, but budget cuts from 2003 have severely hampered our ability to deliver history to the public. History, like the outdoors and arts, is popular among Minnesotans. We enjoy one of the largest memberships of historical organizations in the country with over 19,000 members, and we serve nearly a million people a year with in-person visits and 6 million virtual visits to our various web resources. In many ways, history knits all of this together. Mr. Redmond talked about the Blagan History of Minnesota book. He cited that. We have heard about Theodore Roosevelt talking to the Outdoors Rally. And the film that you have seen in previous committee hearings and that you'll see again later today uses history extensively. In fact, a number of the commentators are Minnesota Historical Society staff members. Mr. Drake from the Forest History Center, staff from the Kelly Farm, the St. Anthony Falls area. So history is able to contribute to the understanding of the environment and outdoors in a unique way, and we would appreciate any support you can give to including history as part of this overall proposal. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Happy to.
Questions for Mr. Kelleher?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Beckman, are you ready to speak?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm apologizing that I wasn't here earlier. I was down testifying in the Health Committee. My name is Kristen Beckman. I'm with the Service Employees International Union. I represent about 28,000 workers that are in public schools, nursing homes, hospitals, the janitors and the downtown security officers and child care providers. I'll be very brief. We have no objection where the money is intended to go in any of the bills being considered. All valid causes. We just have concerns about always where the money comes from. Our nursing home workers rely on the general fund for their wages. Our school employees rely on the general fund for their pensions. Our child care providers rely on the general fund for the ability to take care of the kids and the families that they serve. So anytime anyone talks about taking money out of the general fund, we get a little nervous. And so we really do encourage you, as Senator Richterman pointed out earlier, to consider, you know, raising taxes in order to do these very valuable things for our community, but to please consider the people whose lives and wages and salaries and pensions and health care rely on the general fund when you consider taking existing sales tax revenue out of the general fund. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Beckman? Thank you. Is there anyone else from the audience that would like to testify? Particularly just public citizens. Okay, well, I want to thank everyone for their patience through these hearings. I think we had some wonderful testimony on dedicated funding. I think we're going to vote on this on Wednesday, next Wednesday.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Will we have committee discussion before we do that, or is that intent to just assume that we've taken all of this in isolation and not have any
exchange
internal discussion?
Oh, absolutely. We will. Do you mean in the form of debate
Wednesday.
And discussion on Wednesday? Absolutely.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Senator
Seidman. And Mr. Chair, are we going to vote on each individual bill or?
We're going to vote on one bill.
One bill.
Do you want to one bill?
Yeah. And as I mentioned,
will we know about that in advance?
Yes, there's going to be. Just keep an eye on your agendas, the committee notice. And there's also going to be, I'm going to propose a delete all amendment at least the day before the hearing. And so that'll be available to the members to examine and prepare amendments if you'd like to. And it'll also be available to the public as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, then we'll be voting on the delete all.
Yes.
Bill?
Yes.
And we can have that so we got time to look at it?
Yes. Yes. And if you've got input on the delete all as well, I welcome that.
Would that, Mr. Chairman, be before or after you present us with a printed copy?
Before and after.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, moving on. Presentation of a wetland report. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Brimmer. If you'd introduce yourself, and perhaps you can maybe start with the context of this report. And
let's see if I can get the technology to work. We had it working.
I think it just needs to be turned on. And
okay. I can manage.
Members, there's a written statement from Dave Zentner that's being passed out as well.
Thank you. Ready?
Proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Brimmer. I'm the legal director with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I want to thank Chairman and the committee for this invitation today. This is going to be an informational sort of a sharing here today, and it's going to be about the state of our wetlands and the Wetland Conservation Act. This is just a little bit about our organization. If you're not already familiar with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, we're just a Minnesota-based nonprofit. We work on a number of areas in the environment. In particular, what's going to be relevant here today is wildlife and natural resources is one of our program areas. And we have worked in the area of wetlands for a very long time. We use legal tools, legislative tools, policy tools, and we do things like the report that we're going to present to you today. And just briefly, where this report comes from, we were one of the groups that participated in that first, and in fact the second, Ducks and Wetlands rally at the Capitol. And when we began our preparation for that first one, we wanted to make it meaningful for our organization and some of the work that we did on wetlands. And we realized that that rally would be attended by people that were out on the landscape doing hunting, fishing activities, boating activities, folks that would be able to see firsthand what's happening to Minnesota's wetlands. And so we, at our table at the Wetland Rally, had a Tell Us Your Wetland Story form. And we asked folks to share what they were observing on the landscape. And we were surprised at just how much response we got to that. It was actually quite a bit. We spent the summer then checking it out. We would go and do public document requests. We would go actually look at the landscape, try to get a picture and a broad picture of what was happening to wetlands, good, bad, indifferent, legal, not legal, just all the way across the board, so that we could then write this report, which we are going to summarize for you today, about just what exactly is happening with our Wetland Conservation Act. So let me begin with just a little background. This we use with permission of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. This and the following two maps are theirs. This is pre-settlement, or what we would normally consider roughly pre-settlement wetlands. And if you look at this on the Bowser website, you can see there's actually different shadings for different wetland types. But you can see that Minnesota was a pretty wet state. This is what it looks like now, and I use the term loosely for now, because this is from 1984, and unfortunately, we do not have more recent information than that. So this is pre-settlement. This is 1984 and going forward, and you can see it's a pretty stark contrast in terms of the amount of wetlands lost. Some of those areas have lost 90 to 100% of their pre-settlement wetlands. This is just another Board of Water and Soil Resources map showing roughly the same thing. We've provided you with a fact sheet that has that map on it. I apologize, the color quality is not great, but it'll give you a general idea. And in that, this, too, is from older data, and I would submit that some of those counties in the middle that are light green may be moving into pink colors, and you can see that that obviously corresponds with urban and suburban development, which is fast becoming one of the number one reasons that we are continuing to lose wetlands, and we will talk about that a little bit more later. That's the map background, if you will. Let's talk about the legal background. We have both federal and state laws to protect our wetlands. Both of them subscribe to what I'm sure you have heard, the no net lost concept, being that if in certain circumstances we have to lose a wetland or a certain type of wetland, we want to make sure that we replace it with a wetland of equal value, meaning, you know, habitat value, water quality value on the landscape. There are some replacement ratios that are written so that we would hope to actually make gains. Both the state and our federal, both the federal and our state wetland laws subscribe to that no net loss concept, and that's really what we were looking at. How is that no net loss within the regulations working? And let me be clear about that. I am talking about the regulatory structure. We do not in this analysis include voluntary programs or programs where somebody just creates a wetland on their property, because that's not part of that no net loss equation. The no net loss was supposed to be within the confines of the law itself. That's what the law was supposed to achieve, and I want to make sure we're really clear about that. A little bit on what happened in the federal law. These are some federal studies that have occurred. You see them over the course of 5 years or so. The most recent was a year ago and was done by the General Accountability Office at the request of Representative Overstar. And those studies all say the same thing. At the federal level, no net loss is not working. We are continuing to lose wetlands in terms of number. We are also losing wetlands in terms of quality and diversity. And every one of these reports pretty clearly states that. Same thing, really, is happening at the state level. These are reports of our own Board of Water and Soil Resources trying to report on what's happening on the landscape. The most recent, covering the period of 2001 to 2003, that too came out about a year ago. And Bowser reports, we are continuing to lose wetlands despite regulations designed to do no net loss on the landscape. Bowser's report last year estimated 1,367 acres. That's burned into my head, I think. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but considering that we're not supposed to lose any, over 1,000 acres is fairly substantial. More importantly, the Bowser report points out that that is probably an underestimate because Bowser doesn't know. They don't collect the information. There isn't required reporting. So they're a little bit unsure about exactly what the status is, but that is at least what they report in their most recent report on this.
Ms. Bremer, I have a question.
Senator
Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bremer, I've heard Ron Harnack give talks about the amount of wetlands that we gained or lost in the state of Minnesota, and he's been the head of this Board of Soil and Water Resources that you just referenced. And my recollection of what he says does not jive with what you just said. Now, you said something about losing the Bowser says they've lost 300 and some thousand acres of wetlands. I think you said something like that. But is that net loss? Are you factoring in the ones that have been replaced and gained and restored and so forth? Because my recollection is that Ron Harnack figures, I think he said, that we're actually gaining about 50,000 acres of wetlands per year. And he should know, since he's been the head of the Board of Soil and Water Resources all these years. So how do you respond to that?
Ms. Bremer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dill, we actually had Mr. Harnack review our report before we published it because we wanted to make sure that we were on the same page. And he, in fact, agreed with the things that we were saying in terms of the regulation. And let me back up a little bit. We have to be very careful about our terms when we talk about net loss and net gain. And there's been a lot of comparing apples to oranges. The no net loss phrase grows out of and is part of the law, meaning just within the law. Is the law achieving no net loss? Because within the four corners of the law, that's what's supposed to happen. And Mr. Harnack does understand, and he has said, within the four corners of the law, that's true. That is what the Bowser report talks about. What Mr. Harnack and others will tell you is that Bowser has been working very hard, and there is no doubt about that. They have. To try to get some restoration acres out there, to try to get some wetland banking. Of course, we have all kinds of federal and state programs like CREP that are trying to make a difference on the landscape, and we are having some success with that. The problem and the reason why that doesn't get counted in the regulatory no net loss equation is because those are voluntary only. They can be taken out. You can't count on them. They might be dependent on, for example, federal funding that is here today, gone tomorrow, depending on what happens. And so that's why you have to keep your counting of those things separate. And we are looking at the regulation only. The regulation's supposed to result in no net loss all by itself without the voluntary programs. And what we are finding is it's not quite getting there.
Follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bremer, okay, but when you run around the state saying that we're losing so many thousands of wetlands per year and so on, and the no net loss goal is not being achieved and so forth, don't you create an impression that things are going to hell in a handbag, and if we're really gaining 50,000 acres a year, if that number is correct, if I remember that correctly, why not also say that, so you can kind of give the public the impression or all the information so they can understand totally how all these different programs are working.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, we are not trying to mislead. We are trying to be very clear that we are talking about within the four corners of the wetland regulation. And in fact, first of all, I don't think it is 50,000. That strikes me as extraordinarily high.
What is it then?
But at any rate, the reason that we don't count those is, as I said, we can't count on those being there. Sometimes they are not. When you are counting things that are happening with CREP and some of that, we are still not getting at what the law means to get at. Some of those are not necessarily high-quality wetlands. Some of them may be mixed stormwater control, which are not normally counted as wetlands that you get credit for under the Wetland Conservation Act, because they are not high-quality wetlands, or they may not be in a place where they are giving the habitat value. In other words, the known net loss refers not just to number of acres, but it also refers to types of wetlands, diversity of wetlands, and where they are on the landscape. And so, again, to be able to really keep your comparisons apples to apples, that's why our report focuses within the four corners of the regulation. But we do make that clear, that is the reference point that we are talking about.
Thank you. I think that was an important clarification that you requested, Senator Dill. Why don't we continue with the presentation? We'll get plenty of questions at the end.
Okay, thank you. In preparing our report, as I said, we used the case studies that grew out of the stories that we collected at the Wetlands and Duck Rally to try to get a picture of what was happening on the landscape, and to then group that into different categories under the Wetland Conservation Act. This is by no means completely comprehensive. We were a little nonprofit. We had one graduate-level researcher. We did as much as we could in the summer, and we published this report then last February. I am actually working on our second report and hope to follow up and cover some additional areas and would hope to publish that this spring. So I just wanted to make sure that we were clear that this is part of what we found. We can break it into three different areas. Why are we seeing wetland loss in terms of acres and or diversity on the landscape? And we broke it into several basic categories. One is that when the Wetland Conservation Act was first passed in 1991, it necessarily included some compromises. It was a difficult bill to pass. There were a lot of folks that had a lot of interests, and it appropriately represented a compromise and a step in the right direction. And because of that, it includes a number of exemptions. It also, in a couple of places, because we can't all be completely prescient and understand what we are doing, there are a few loopholes that have turned up that no one probably anticipated when we first started working on this. So that represents one category of why there are still some losses. We have found inadequate enforcement, and let me be clear on that. This is not a criticism of our very hardworking DNR, which you are going to hear from. If they are struggling with wetland enforcement, it is entirely a result of them just not having enough people on the ground to do the work. They have five officers that cover the state, and that is extraordinarily difficult for the magnitude of work that we have. We did, however, identify some inadequate federal enforcement in some situations, and that, I think, there is perhaps a lack of will there, and our report refers to that. Finally, we identified some outdated and mismatched laws with respect to drainage, and I will talk about that a little bit more detail later in the slideshow and some of our solutions on how to make that work better for all that are concerned. So these are the three basic areas that we identified. So I'm going to start with some examples. Again, this does not by any means cover the entire landscape or all of our report, but it gives you a flavor of what we are talking about. There are exemptions for agricultural activities, particularly in types 1 and 2 wetlands. Those are the smaller, more seasonal, if you will, type wetlands. What you see here in this field is possibly a type 1 wetland. In other words, it just looks like a wet spot part of the year. What we are finding out, though, from groups like Ducks Unlimited and the research, the scientific research they have been funding and participating in, these are really, really important to migratory waterfowl. They melt out first in the year. They become productive with food first part of the year rather than some of the larger lakes and wetlands. This goes to that diversity of wetlands that we were talking about. The ag exemption is in statute for a reason. There are a lot of wetlands that are farmed. There are a lot of federal exemptions for wetlands, but we just identify this as one of the areas of exemptions. And there have been some enforcement difficulties with this at the federal level with the Swamp Buster Law. So that is one of the other things that we did identify in the report. When I get to solutions, I will talk about the solution, but to calm any nerves that there might be, we do not, let me repeat, do not suggest doing away with the wetland exemption for the agricultural exemption. We do suggest making it more clear and a little bit easier to administer. So let me move on. Anybody who's from rural Minnesota knows what that is. That's drain tile. And we wouldn't be able to farm a lot of parts of Minnesota without drain tile. It makes our farms more productive. It's important, but this is a piece of the puzzle. Our exemptions right now for drainage say that you can replace your drain tile, you can repair and clean out old ditches as long as you don't increase your drainage. In other words, you don't make it more than it was or drain wetlands in the process. And again, we aren't suggesting changing that. What is happening on the landscape, though, is that increased or better technologies with respect to tiling and other farm drainage practices are in some cases increasing drainage, even though they don't set out to do that. Also, we are hearing from Fish and Wildlife and some others that perimeter tiling, in other words, you put tile all the way around a wetland, can be starving a wetland of water and can change its hydrology. So those are some things that we are saying we need to think about, not change the exemption generally, but think about some of these things that maybe we didn't know about back in 91. Let's turn to some of the other exemptions. I'm going to skip the approved development exemption in the interest of time. It was sort of a grandfathering in of folks that already had their permits to do development. It's sort of fading into the sunset need-wise, but there is a rather startling example and a startling case study in our report about how that can be used and abused. And so our suggestion is it's outlived its useful life. It might be time for that to go. But let's talk about de minimis. There's a de minimis exemption in your Wetland Conservation Act, and it says, breaks the state down into roughly three pieces. And it says in certain areas you can drain, fill, or otherwise impact a wetland as long as it's only so many square feet. And it's the state is broken up by three. In the northeastern part of the state or the northern part of the state where we still have a lot of wetlands, that's a fairly large or a larger piece. I think it's 10,000 square feet. And then it reduces as you move south and west. And it corresponds to how many wetlands are remaining on the landscape, and that's the de minimis exemption as it exists. This exemption, though, does result in a chipping away at our wetlands. And just this year, in its informal work, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, in their stakeholder process that we were a participant in, identified the de minimis exemption as a significant reason we are continuing to lose wetland acres. It does appear to be the one exemption that is having a pretty big impact on what is happening with our wetlands. Here's one of our case studies. In Baxter, Minnesota, there was a property owner, and he had a fairly large piece of property, and he applied for a de minimis exemption. And I think that's in the in-between area, so it's probably in the 5,000 square feet area, if I recall correctly. They said, okay, and he said, well, but I got a lot of wetlands on the site. There were a lot of wetlands sort of dotted throughout. You can imagine that being in central Minnesota, what that looked like. And the problem was that with just that single de minimis exemption for that large parcel wasn't really going to get this landowner out of the obligations under the Wetland Conservation Act. So they pulled it off the table, came back with a new proposal, had sold half of the land to Walmart, and now wanted a de minimis exemption for just each piece. Now, technically, they're not supposed to do that under the rules, but the local government unit ultimately granted that. And this is where I'm talking about death by a thousand cuts. The Walmart piece that got the de minimis exemption preserved a few wetlands, but this is what they look like. This one's between the highway and the parking lot. This one's on the edge of the parking lot, and then we have that one. When I gave this presentation to the Ducks Unlimited guys, the one guy said, well, that's real nice. They left the boat ramp there for me on opening day. No self-respecting duck is going to show up there. So that really does get to some of the diversity issues, too. We may have preserved the acres, but what are we really doing on the landscape? Let's turn to drainage. There are drainage exemptions in the Wetland Conservation Act. Again, we are not proposing to take those away. They are an important part of our agricultural economy. They serve an important function. But what we found is that there's a lot of confusion back and forth between the drainage code, Chapter 103E, and the wetland stuff in 103G, that they don't refer to each other very well. There's some confusion with respect to some definitions that maybe could be better worked out about repair and maintenance, because the wetland exemptions are that you can go ahead and do repair of your drainage systems, including ditches, cleanouts, things like that, as long as you're really replacing it back to where it was, back to normal, and if you don't affect a wetland that's been in place for 25 years or more, meaning that the wetland, that maybe the drainage system was so out of repair for so long that the wetland reestablished itself on the landscape, and the wetland had to be reestablished for 25 years. So you can imagine that that can be a little hard to administer. People have to keep track of what was going on. And what we are finding is we're getting some confusion. So I'm going to give you a couple case studies there. This is just an example of a recently cleaned out ditch. This was legal. This was okay. You can see that it is draining some of the wooded wetlands that are further back in there. But this is an example of what drainage is. This is a case that we've worked on in Washington County. This is Rice Lake. It was within the Paul Hugo Farms Wildlife Management Area. It does have a ditch, both coming in and going out, a judicial ditch. That has been the source of contention for some time. They did what they considered routine maintenance, and that's what the lake looked like afterwards. Now, the watershed district said, oops, we didn't mean to do that. The lake has been replaced and repaired. They did put an earthen plug back in there, but that ditch continues to be contentious. The city of Hugo just this summer applied to clean it out again and then did withdraw their application after some discussions. But I put that out there as an example of how these issues could use some work. They could use some clarity. This one's in Pine County. This looks beautiful, right? It's all green, there's water, it's really nice, except, and this was in fact illegal, the county went after the guy that did this, you used to be able to jump across this ditch. This is what it looked like post-cleanout. This is what the lake upstream looked like post-cleanout. The guy whose property this was used to be able to park his pontoon boat at that dock. Now, the lake has recovered a little bit because the county has required there to be some repair work, but that, too, continues to be a contentious issue over that ditch in terms of what is going on with it. And the lake, while it has recovered some, has not returned to the level where you can probably pull a pontoon boat into this dock. So that, too, are some of the case studies. Finally, there are some enforcement issues. Minnesota Statutes 15.99, as you know, requires local governments to make certain decisions within 60 days, or the application is automatically approved. It is proving problematic in the area of wetlands regulation, and there is a lot of litigation going on about this, and that's partly because this can be some complicated science stuff. If you're going to apply to do something relative to wetlands, somebody's got to go out and delineate it. There might be a technical evaluation panel. You got to find out what kind it is, where it is. That usually involves soil samples. It might require monitoring wells. If you are going to affect the wetlands, you have to file a mitigation plan saying, I'm going to fix it this way over here. That's complicated and technical.
The short of it is that it's very difficult to get that job done and done well in this very short period of time that this statute gives. And we've got some case studies that show that people are getting automatically approved to impact wetlands when nobody really meant to have that happen because of the operation of this statute in its very short timelines. And then I've already touched on enforcement resources. I'm going to just leave it at that. You're going to hear a little bit from a DNR enforcement officer, Julie Olson, after me. She's got fabulous stuff to inform you about what DNR is finding on the landscape and their flyovers. Possible solutions to this? Monitoring and reporting of exemptions would help. We would then actually understand what we are really missing. Maybe it's not that bad. Maybe it's worse than we thought. We would propose something very simple, like just a checkoff form. Doesn't affect your ability to get the exemption. You get it, you get it. But you would come into the county, maybe you send it to Bowser, and you say, I hereby claim this exemption. For some people that use them repeatedly, like agricultural exemptions, I think you would just do it once. There's no reason to make people do that every year, but we need to start getting a handle on this information. Provide funding to our state agencies that are trying to monitor this and figure out what's going on. And possibly even reporting to the governor would be helpful, because I think that this is an important enough issue to a large enough number of constituents that this would be a really good thing for us to have happen. Let's talk about some of the exemptions. Let's make sure that we retain our independent state authority over the agricultural exemptions and get those a little bit clarified so that we're not just reliant on the tangled web of the federal government and what they're funding or not funding or allowing or not allowing. I think that it's our wetlands, it's our state, and we ought to be able to exercise our own authority. Use the inventory that's going on right now. Fish and Wildlife, DNR, and some others are participating in it to try to get restoration of some types 1 and 2. Those are those little ones I showed you in that first slide. They have been really hammered. We have lost huge, huge numbers of those types 1 and 2 that ducks really like and really need when they are migrating north in the spring in particular. So we're saying let's try to focus some effort on those especially. And then we need to revise some of these other exemptions. The old outdated approved development, and we've talked about de minimis. We think that the de minimis could be cut back some and that that would have a positive impact. Clarify drainage exemptions. I'll just go through these quickly. Maybe have a little bit more of a public process. A lot of the cases that walk in our door are just because nobody knew what was going on. And suddenly a wetland's gone, or suddenly there's spoil banks that are new. If we just had a little bit more notice, a little bit more ability for landowners and others to participate, that might help some of the contentiousness on the landscape. Similar public notice process, consideration of the environment, some of that's in the drainage code already. Let's just match up the drainage code and the Wetland Conservation Act. And let's make sure that we can abandon ditches if they really aren't being used anymore. That's a slow, laborious process for local governments. Some of those folks in Pine County have been talking to us on that one situation saying, you know, maybe we should just abandon this ditch. It's not really giving a lot of benefit to many people anymore. But that process is so expensive and laborious for counties that they don't do it. So that's another suggestion. Enforcement, we were thinking about a wetland SWAT team. In other words, let's have some more wetland enforcement officers so that they can really do the right job. More enforcement resources, citizen enforcement authority similar to under the Clean Water Act. There are a lot of folks out on the landscape that know what's going on. They could help us understand that and help the enforcement of this. And that's all. And I'll wait for questions. I hope I didn't take too long. Try to go fast. I did have the letter from Dave Zentner. That actually is from me. I talked to Dave Zentner. He really wanted to be here today, but has been down here a lot. And so he asked that I provide the letter to the committee. Thank you.
Has your group done much study of wetlands within the metro area as well? How does the wetlands within the metro coincide with what you're proposing?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's an excellent question, and in fact, we are working a lot on wetlands within the metro area. That Washington County ditch case is, in fact, within the what most people would consider the larger metropolitan area. It's developing pretty rapidly out there. We have worked on a number of cases sort of right up against Carlos Avery Wildlife Management Area, and we have some concerns for the quality of the wildlife management area. And in fact, in our opinion and experience, while agriculture has perhaps really significantly influenced the landscape relative to wetlands, I would say that development is fast becoming as much and may quickly overtake that in terms of impacts to wetlands, and we should not ignore that, that our urbanizing landscape, whether it's the Twin Cities or St. Cloud spreading out its boundaries or whichever, is really having a significant impact on wetlands.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, first of all, there's a federal farm program exemption in the 1991 Wetland Conservation Act, and if your farm is in the federal farm program, which has very strict wetland conservation requirements, you're not covered by the law you're talking about, the state law. So, and I don't know what the percent is of farmland in this state that's in the federal farm program, but it's got to be high. I'm maybe going to guess 90% or so. So that's one point. Second point is a question for Ms. Bremer. You said that the de minimis is so big, it's a major cause of wetland loss in this state. And you failed to mention that most of the state has a 400-square-foot de minimis, which is less than a hundredth of an acre. Why don't you tell me how many acres are lost per year in Minnesota because the de minimis is so big?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I can't tell you how many acres are lost because that's one of the problems we've identified, which is that Bowser does not have access to that records. Nobody keeps track of how much is lost de minimis. Informally, Bowser has said that they believe that the vast majority of those 1,300 acres that they reported are probably coming from de minimis impacts. But unfortunately, nobody does have a specific amount. And I think you're right. There is a 400-foot de minimis. I think that's for shorelands only, but I don't have the law in front of me, so I couldn't tell you that for sure. I think that's for something that is contiguous to a lake or a stream.
No, that's, Mr. Chairman, members, that's what it is for most of the state in this. It's 400 square foot. It's a very small de minimis. Now, I want to get back to this wetland law, and you're only talking about the four corners of the 1991 Wetland Conservation Act. How many acres are you saying have been lost? How many in the state? How many acres of wetlands have we lost?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, are you talking about since the passage of the 91 Act or just most recent report?
Well, give me your numbers right now. I mean, your point is we've lost so many. The law isn't working. We've lost so many acres. It's very bad. How many acres have we lost?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, again, I can only rely on what Bowser is telling us, and they are saying that just in that period from 2001 to 2003, which is the most recent period we have data for, we've got a loss of 1,367, which they say is underestimating. I can, if you want historic, let me go all the way back here.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bremer, okay, that's how many we've lost. How many have we gained in that period of time?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, again, I'm sorry to be a broken record, but nobody keeps records of that, so we just don't know.
But your point is we've lost so many. In that three-year period, you say we've lost 1,367 acres, but the Wetland Conservation Act requires replacement at a 2-to-1 ratio or 3-to-1 or 1-to-1, depending on what situation you're in. So how many acres have we gained?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, that part is a net loss. That's what we're talking about. In other words, that the replacement and mitigation components of the Wetland Conservation Act are not serving the function that they were meant to serve, which is to either replace or even increase, as you pointed out, wetland acres that are impacted. And that is what we are saying. That is indeed resulting in a net loss, that within that regulatory structure, it is not working. It's not working at the federal level, and it's not working at the state level.
I think Senator Dill is asking is, you gave the example of the the stormwater pond,
mm-hmm.
with the boat ramp. How can we quantify how much of that is happening? To answer Senator Dill's question about, you know, you've established, I think, that the rules allow for that type of thing, but how much of that is actually going on?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, again, the difficulty of doing that in any kind of detailed way is that Bowser has tried to canvass the counties for some information informally over the course of the summer, but they are the first to admit that the counties didn't all respond. They don't all keep track of that. So we don't really know exactly. What I can tell you is things like the boat ramp, like those mitigation acres, if those are either counted as not a loss, because arguably the Walmart wetlands weren't affected, or if somebody creates a wetland as part of their mitigation obligation or restores a wetland, that's what we're saying is even with those, counting those that are restored under the Wetland Conservation Act or avoided under the Wetland Conservation Act, it appears that it's not matching up. It's not meeting the number of acres and diversity that are being lost.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Brimmer, the crux of your whole testimony here is that the Wetland Conservation Act is not working. We're losing wetlands and so on. I'm just asking for some simple numbers here. The law was passed in 91. It took a couple of years to get the rules in place and so on. We did some modifications during the last decade. And you threw out this number, 1,367 acres during a three-year period. I'm just looking for some, just to put this in context, how many acres have we lost and how many acres have we restored or gained? And then I can do the arithmetic myself and find out what the net loss is that you're claiming.
Senator Dill, I think the point Ms. Brimmer is trying to make through her presentation, and that's one of the proposals they are suggesting, is that we need to quantify this a lot better. In the meantime, there are numerous examples, as they are citing, where the intent of the law that we already have is not meeting the actual experience.
Well,
and I think you're absolutely correct in asking for actual numbers, and I think that's part of their proposal, and what I'm sensing is part of this group's frustration is that those numbers are lacking for the work they are trying to do.
Well, I, Mr. Chairman, members, I have personal experience selling numerous wetlands and a permanent wetland easement to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And that's wetlands that are protected forever.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about how some of these programs are hit and miss and they're short term, this, that, and so forth. And I've also restored wetlands on my own farm just because I'm interested in it. And I think this idea that we're actually losing wetlands in the state of Minnesota is probably blown out of proportion. And I get back to what Ron Harnack said. I think he said we're gaining 50,000 acres a year if you look at everything. Now, the guy behind you is shaking his head.
He's not with me.
I don't know what the number is, but that wetland law is so darn tough. I just can't believe we're losing wetlands, especially when you factor in all the other programs that are out there to restore and protect wetlands.
Mr. Chairman, Remember. Senator Dill, and I appreciate the committee's frustration. I mean, I'm frustrated, too. I want to be able to come to you and say, you know, we know this county did this, we know this county did this, and that was part of the point of the report, is I think that there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. There's a lot of concern by hunting and fishing and conservation groups, a lot of concern by environmental groups. And we were trying to kind of, if you will, put a face on it and show the case studies, report what we do know, which is what is in the Bowser reports. But I think that is indeed a frustration for you, for us, that nobody really does have a good handle on it. And I think that some of the reporting reporting things that we are suggesting, some of the funding for inventories, would be a really helpful thing for this body, for citizens that are concerned, for agencies that are trying to work on it.
Just one more comment.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, members, the use of the word SWAT team is offensive.
Don't do it.
And if you think that the private landowners are going to be interested in letting hunters on their land and having the part of the government out there with SWAT teams to raise hell with landowners, it's going to backfire.
Point taken, Senator Dill. Senator Bickerman, did you have your hand up? Okay, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brimmer, this may seem like kind of an inane question, but I ask them every once in a while. If you took the whole state of Minnesota, pre-settlement wetlands, we're breaking it up here, but if you just took the whole state pre-settlement, how much still remains of the pre-settlement? What percentage? Do you have any idea?
Just a
ballpark?
You mean total in terms
of? If, you know, we note that the Arrowhead portion is between 90 and 100, mm-hmm. But ultimately that, I don't know, that may have been 60% of the total wetlands pre-settlement. So I'm just wondering how much we actually have lost.
That is, Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxon, that's a number I can actually give you.
Okay.
And that's not an inane question. That's an important question. In fact, you get slightly like by a 0.5% or 1%, depending on if you talk to Fish and Wildlife Service or if you talk to Bowser. But there's rough agreement that a little bit less than 50%, if you measure it statewide, if you lump the whole state together, a little bit less than half of our wetlands remain, somewhere in the 48-49%.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions for the witness? Ms. Brimmer was arguing before the Supreme Court just this morning, just before the hearing.
Actually, it got put off.
Okay.
But thank you for the acknowledgement.
I was going to ask you which panel was tougher.
Always this one. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Julie Olson, DNR.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Julie Olson. I'm a Wetlands Enforcement Officer with the DNR Enforcement Division, and I was asked to put on a presentation about our flights last year and our workload that we did in dealing with the Wetland Conservation Act. Last year, we embarked on an unprecedented aerial detection of what was going on in the landscape. Conservation officers are routinely patrolling every inch of the state of Minnesota, and yet there are areas that they cannot see from the road or from driveways or whatever. And so we decided we'd take a kind of a glimpse, a snapshot of what was going on by looking down from the air. Our goal was to increase the detection of the violations. What are officers not seeing out there in routine patrol? Because we don't know. We don't know what we are not catching. We wanted to expand educational efforts, get the message out, get the word out about the Wetland Conservation Act, and that was very successful. We had a lot of people calling, a lot of people coming into the local government units in the counties asking about it because they heard about it or they read about it in the news. So it did bring additional attention and awareness to that. And we even had people that called up and wanted to report themselves that they had done some work in a wetland and did not know that that was illegal and wanted to make sure that what they had done was okay and actually took steps to correct those if it was illegal activities. So that was very, very positive. This is basically what the pilot sees from the air. This is one that he did prior to our actual flights, but when he's flying to and from, if he spots a possible impact, and I'm going to clarify, if we have an impact, that doesn't mean that it's a violation because of the exemptions and certain activities that are allowed. We identify those as possible impacts to a wetland. In this case here, we did have some excavation along with fill in a wetland that would not have been allowed. You can see the arrow towards the area of excavation, and this is a type 3, 4 wetland, maybe even a 5, and excavation is not allowed in those type of wetlands because of the displacement of the fill, the dirt, the sediment. It plumes out and can have a long-lasting effect on that wetland and the vegetation that grows there. And in this case, the skid steer was still in place. It was still on the site. We flew in our flights. I lasted through the summer. I was the first wetlands enforcement officer to start the process, and we started April 1st, and this continued into September. We flew 24 counties. Some were completely flown. We spent 2 days in those particular counties. Some we only flew a part of the county, and part of that was just due to the number of impacts that the pilot was recording. And again, I use the term impact, not violation, because from the air, you can't be sure that you actually have a violation on the ground. So he would spot an impact, and then he'd GPS that location and snap a photo, and then he'd spot another one as he was turning around. And in some areas, especially around development corridors, it was so much that he said he got dizzy as he was circling around one particular spot to the next. So we certainly didn't accomplish what we had intended, at least in I flew 6 of my counties, and I cover the central part of the state, and it was just unbelievable what we were discovering. Now, those were numbers and impacts, not what was actual violations. We found statewide 542 possible impacts that were recorded by the pilot and the observer. 316 of those were impacts. And when I say impacts, they were either an exemption or they were an approved replacement plan. The people had come through the front door, proposed to do the impact to the wetland, got the approval, and then had done the impact. So it was an impact, but it was an approved impact, whether it was de minimis or an ag exemption type of a deal. 148 were actual violations where we issued cease and desist orders, and 77 are still pending investigation. It seems like a high number, but last summer with the flights and the drought, the workload was absolutely overwhelming statewide for all the counties involved in the flights and those that weren't involved in the flights. Being that we were so dry, people were able to get into areas that normally they couldn't have with a backhoe. And so that increased the people wanting to do excavation, do the legal stuff, and also do illegal stuff as well. So the workload was just unbelievable for 2006. Every possible impact that we identified.
Excuse me, Ms. Olson, there was a question from one of the
members. Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator
Mr. Chair, I'm the chair of the Ag Committee, and when I'm watching his presentation, there's an awful lot of talk about how bad ag is. I will guarantee you that people I rep in my county are the first ones to protect their waters. I want to know if you flew that plane over the 7-county metro area. That's what I hear from my hometown. We can't do anything, but you go up to Metro, and they want to build development. They just fill them in and make another one over there. Did you fly in the 7 county, or you just, when you said statewide, you should look at every one of those counties. Did you or didn't you?
We did fly some of the counties in the Metro area. Okay. And I'm sorry if I didn't address the Mr. Chairman and the committee properly, but.
That's all right. You didn't mention which 24 counties you were in, and I think that's a fair question. Was there a fair distribution of those counties?
What we tried to focus on was highway corridors and development areas. This was not targeted at any particular group. Enforcement is not trying to pick on any particular group or identify any particular group. I think we have some very environmental conscientious farmers out there, and we have some very environmental friendly developers out there as well. So I certainly do not want to paint a broad brush of any particular group being worse than another. I think this is an important environmental issue, no matter where you come from or what your background is. And I do have a list of the counties. I didn't put that in part of the PowerPoint.
That would be nice at some point if you could send that to the committee.
Certainly.
Why didn't you, 24 isn't that many. Why don't you just read them?
Do you have a list that you could just read off to the
committee? Yep, I do, Mr. Chairman. Anoka County, Becker, Beltrami, Benton, Big Stone, Cass, Chisago, Clearwater, Crow Wing, Douglas, Hubbard, Le Sueur, Mille Lacs, Ottertail, Pennington, Pine, Polk, Polk, Scott, Sherburne, St. Louis, Stearns, Stevens, Wright, and others. And when I say others, those were counties that the pilot identified a possible impact that wasn't in the scheduled flight, but it was he picked up something and made note of it.
Do you recall how many violations were cited in Anoka County?
There was 44 possibles in Anoka County. 14 were identified as impacts after we looked at the initial ones from the pilot. 7 were violations, and there are no pending in Anoka County.
I represent portions of Anoka County, Senator Vickerman. It's interesting for me to know. Go ahead and continue with your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Each possible impact was identified, and we reviewed that. The wetland enforcement officers were provided that data by the pilot, and we followed up with the local government units in order to sort out what was non-wetland. And again, from the air, sometimes that's hard to tell, especially in the earlier spring flights that I had. You couldn't necessarily tell it was wetland. Vegetation was all dead and brown. So we had to sort out what was non-wetland, what were approved impacts, and that was for the local government unit to inform me. You know, we already had an approved replacement plan, so that impact is okay. And this one, they came in through the front door, and they're under de minimis. So we weeded those out, and we created a file then on the ones that were still pending. Those were provided to the local conservation officers for the follow-up. Conservation officers, local government units, soil and water conservation districts, and the wetland enforcement officers conducted numerous site visits. Cease and desist orders were issued to landowners that were in violation. We did wetland delineations, and again, that's very scientific, and it does take a lot of time when you're out on site and you have a disturbed site to determine what is the wetland boundary and what would not be the wetland. And we worked very closely with the landowners. One of the things with the Wetland Conservation Act that is a little bit different is that it's a civil process, and we try to get people to comply, inform them of the reasons why we have the act and what its purpose and goals are. And what I have found is people really want to understand and do the right thing. So we work really closely with the landowners that are cooperative and want to understand. So we take a lot of time to spend with the landowners and work with them. And the work, again, was compounded by the state's drought. It just, with that drier season, the workload just got really large. So in 2006, statewide, and there might be a few more that haven't been sent in to our where we collect our data, but statewide we had 526 cease and desist orders issued for the state. That's just for the Wetlands Conservation Act. That does not include the wetland, public waters, or the aquatic plants that we deal with as wetland enforcement officers.
Question, Ms. Olson. Senator Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that last slide, you had 500 and some odd cease and desist orders on the Wetland Conservation Act. How many of those were ag, had anything to do with agriculture? And then earlier you said you had 148 violations that you picked up from the air in those 24 counties, which averages about 6 violations per county. How many of those were agriculture?
Solson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, we did not keep track of necessarily what was clearly an agricultural versus a development. We tried to capture that data, but I think it was more important just to look at the big picture again. So we didn't break down out of these 526. It's not like we get to check a box when we issue a cease and desist that this is an agricultural-related impact. They're just impacts that are in violation. And maybe that's something that could be done differently, but we didn't really capture that specific number.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, ma'am, do you have a kind of a gut level feel whether it was approximately a quarter of them or an eighth, or was it, I mean, without being scientific, as if you've examined many of them?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson, I think inferred from the talk that maybe that it was going after agriculture, and obviously that's not the case. But do you have any just sense of how that breakout might be?
Ms. Olson.
Again, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, in my area, we focused on the development, and I cover, again, 10 counties in the central part of the state, and I have agricultural in half my area, and I have more of the wooded areas up to the northeast over towards Pine County. In Stearns County, I would say about, and this is only an approximate without concrete numbers, maybe 25% to 30% in Stearns County may have been agricultural. And again, it would be an impact. We're still sorting through with the agricultural ones in some of the counties which ones will qualify for an exemption.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
This is a typical fill violation that we see. I guess I tried to grab a couple of photos to show you what's going on the ground and from the air out in the countryside. So this is what's happening. We get fill violations. They're trying to put in a shed or something, and you know, you can see in the background, and they're actually buried as cattails. So this is definitely what people, the general public, think of as a wetland. This is an example of a fill and an excavation. We had a very nice, very complex site where you had type 7, 8, threes, 1 and 2 wetlands in an area. They had excavated as well as put a road through the wetland without any approved permits or anything. So this one was issued a cease and desist order. This is an example that if we had not had the pilot detect this particular one, what you're seeing is the long stretch that runs from this lower corner to the upper is what was done through winter harvest of forestry products, logging off the islands out there. So they were able to log it off during the winter without any impact other than knocking down the brush. And that's where you see the water. That's water and not fill. But the lighter colors up above are fill placed for roads. And this individual has applied. This was one of our flight ones. Did apply for a forestry exemption. But if you look really closely at the two roads in the upper corner over here, see that those two roads go out to two open water ponds. If you're doing logging, you're not really needing to go to open water ponds. You need to go from island to island. In this case, that was to access it for duck hunting. So the impacts, even though he's claiming forestry, those two particular roads are going to be required to be removed to get him into compliance under the forestry exemption. But from the air, if you weren't in the air, you wouldn't see that or catch that. And this one is actually a very complex wetland area. I'm guessing close to 100 plus acres in total of this wetland complex. And all these islands, they've accessed with roads for forestry. And what was interesting is that the landowner during this process stated that he does intend to sell it off into lots. So the roads are, right now he says for forestry, but future probably development for hunting. Another example of fill and associated excavation. This is a very common one that we see in my area, I think statewide, I could say that very easily. People go into an existing wetland, they want to excavate it out, create the open water, but in that, trying to improve upon what's there naturally, they place the fill, which then takes away the wetland around it, and in some cases can actually cut off hydrology that would overflow into this wetland. We've had that where it's an indirect impact. They've taken away the hydrology, the very hydrology that they want in that pond with these excavation fills. So this one is a violation. Another one. Again, these are probably the most common. A lot of these people that do these do not come in and ask anybody what to do or if they can or how to do it, how to do it right, and what's the best for the environment if they're going to excavate in a wetland. So along with the excavation, you get, and a lot of times with these side slopes on these wetlands, you get this 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 slope because of the back cooperation. Well, for wildlife, that's not what they need. They need gentle slopes. Turtles could have trouble. Ducklings could have trouble getting out of here if a a deer were to go in. You've got these steep, muddy slopes. Very difficult for any wildlife to navigate in and out of these wetland areas. So people think they're doing better for the environment, but if not done properly, can do a lot more harm. This was a ditch violation. The ditch that you see running straight up and down in these photos face north, that is a new ditch. The rest of the clean-out was allowed under an ag exemption, but the new ditch certainly increases the drainage capacity of this agricultural ditch system. So this one here, we're going to have to deal with restoring the new ditch that actually increases the drainage of the wetland, but the existing clean-out will be allowed under the agricultural maintenance exemption. This is another fill violation. Took out a lot of trees and just started pushing them into the wet area. Apparently, they didn't want the open water. And this is one that I think is happening a lot more than we even realize. It's a slow process. This is along the Mississippi River. You can see the wetland. It would be to your right, and people that live along the lakes and stuff want to get rid of their leaves. And so they start hauling them to the wetland across the road or in their backyard, the wet area, the low spot, and they dump the leaves in there. And over time, we get this pretty massive effect. In this particular photo, you can see that it's quite long. And actually, the wetland here comes well past where you see the new leaves. But over 10 years of dumping the leaves here, they have taken away that wetland. And as that starts to become less available, they're going to continue to place more fill further over. And it's a slow eating away, if you will, at the wetlands. And we can't keep track of these. They're everywhere. You can't drive around a lake without seeing some spot along a wetland area where the leaves are being dumped. People even haul them in from close to the lake to dump them along the road because that's become the local leaf dumping spot. And that does have an impact on the wetland. Violations in the workload does continue to grow, and we are still losing the wetlands. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Further questions for Ms. Olson? Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Members, this is the beginning of discussion on wetlands. And whether we like it or not, sooner or later, we as policymakers are going to have to address this issue. And whatever proposals we come up with, we're going to have to make some decisions. And we here in the Environment Committee dealing with wetlands are going to have to try and figure out a way to address the wetland issue. I think what was important for today's discussion is that there is more information needed, that this is a metro as much as it is a greater Minnesota issue, that there is perhaps a lack of knowledge amongst landowners, and that there are some bad actors out there as well. Now, I own land in Fridley, and I have rules that I have to live by, just like lots of other landowners do. I don't get to build my house to the curb. There's setback rules. There's easements. The government owns part of my land, the right to part of my land. So, and that's all for a broader, big picture reason, whether it's for the environment or for development. And so I think we need to not view this as a rural metro issue or a farmer versus development issue. I think this is a Minnesota issue. When thousands of people come to rally at the Capitol because we're losing a lot of our wildlife, we're losing a lot of our natural drainage systems – I think we need to sit up and listen. I think we need to sit up and listen. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate those comments, but isn't that also what we've been talking about and hearing about through the whole discussion of the dedicated funding for preserving and protecting our both fish and wildlife habitat? That's
absolutely.
All part of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can just relate a short story about how this is as much not just metro area, but a core city issue as it is anything else, any as it affects any other part of the state. Back in 1997, I worked for a city council member in Minneapolis, and we had a series of about four or five very intense rainstorms throughout Minneapolis, throughout the metro area, but within Minneapolis. For whatever reason, that year, you know, every couple of weeks, we had very, very intense downpours. And, you know, a number of years ago in Minneapolis, there was a great deal of pressure to build. It's post-World War II, a lot of housing pressure. And what they did was they took all the low-lying areas that had previously been thought to be unbuildable. They were wetlands. They were thought to be, you know, swamps or dumps and, you know, kind of useless areas. And they just decided to fill those in, you know, and the houses that were built in those areas were built on pretty significant pilings so that they were stable. But it ignored the fact that they were still the low-lying areas and caught the water, you know, for the surrounding acres. And so what happened as a result in almost every part of Minneapolis, pretty much every part of Minneapolis, was that those storms came, the water was dumped, you know, there's no place for that water to go within our own storm drain system, because the storm drains in Minneapolis were never really built to accommodate that kind of deluge. As a matter of fact, they're totally inadequate. And so we had just tremendous flooding in those neighborhoods. People's basements filled up, entire neighborhoods completely inundated and made practically inviable. And so we ended up having to figure out how to clear some of those areas, restore the wetlands, create some water retention and some water quality improvement projects to create a larger public good so we could get people out of those circumstances and get that housing out of there. And so you see now around Minneapolis, you know, a couple blocks here and there that are cleared with stormwater detention ponds, you know, kind of natural planting areas surrounding those. There are also some passive recreation areas that are attached to them in some cases. Mm-hmm. So it's as much a core city issue as it is, mm-hmm. You know, a Senator Vickerman issue.
Well, and I can speak for the suburban areas as well. We've got to deal with that stormwater issue as well, because we've paved over and lawned over our what used to be wetlands in mm-hmm. suburbs, and we're gonna be dealing with those same runoff and flooding issues. Two summers ago, when we had the big power outage for 5 days in Fridley and North Metro, the first thing that the city did was come and make sure that those sewers didn't overflow, because that would have been a real disaster. So we're going to have to start thinking about policies that deal with runoff in our district, in our suburban communities as well. Senator Olson, from another suburban member.
I live in the suburban area too, and I do own land, and I have wetlands, and do try to protect them. But it was interesting, because long before I got here, which seems like almost forever, but was involved in local government out in Minnetrista. In Minnetrista, I think, and Orono were two cities that I think had the first wetland protection ordinances. I think it had to have been back in the 60s, that essentially said, thou shalt not touch wetlands. And they were written up nationally. It was quite unique, because it was very common to fill in. And so at least in, you know, there's been challenges in trying to protect those from development, and even with an ordinance. As Ms. Olson from DNR has said, we can have the laws, and it's still, if people don't understand, appreciate, and respect, they're going to try to get by with doing something, there were times when, you know, act and then deal with it later was kind of the policy, where our city council had made people take it out, dig it out, clean up their act. It is a challenge to continue to protect it, because many people still don't understand the value. But I think that is starting to change, and I hope we can keep it on that course.
Well, I mean, you can see that the marsh and the swamp is now being termed as the wetland and the nature pond.
Or a marsh instead of, yes, the swamp.
So attitudes are changing. Did you have your hand up, Senator Vickerman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, all I'm asking is, as a rural legislator, that we all treated fairly in this. And what your people have to understand, out where I live, 150,000 acres under the CREP program got all restored. And every one of those wetlands has got water on it. So it kind of bothers me when they say they don't get no credit for it. We restored them. I restored one myself, 80-acre lake that was used to be. So give us a little credit for some of the things that we have done out there. And I know there's two other areas, and I believe it's in northern Minnesota and one more. We're trying to do some more CREP. I chose to make mine perpetual. And I'm glad I did, because someday I won't be here and the kids can, it's theirs, but they can't plow it up. When I see $4 corn and $5,000 acre land, I can see some people saying, yeah, I'm not so sure that I should have put it in there permanent. I'll just pay it back and I'll still gain. So a lot of that has to be looked at, Mr. Chair, and I have kids in the cities, relation in the cities. Let's just all work together and put a good bill in. My final answer. The noise I'm hearing out there, and I don't know what we're just talking about this bill. What's going to happen when we pass this bill?
What's that?
Well,
I didn't hear your last one.
The comment from Senator Vickerman was people's hair is starting to stand on end just talking about this issue. What's going to happen when we actually have a bill?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
And I think, I think that's why we've taken this approach today. We've introduced this issue, introduced some of the problems, potential solutions. We've had a discussion amongst ourselves. I think we've come to an understanding that this issue clearly applies to all Minnesotans. And I assure you that whatever we do in this committee is going to apply to all of us. All of us.
Mr. Chairman,
so your comments are well taken, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, the two maps that were shown that showed the original wetlands and then today seem to show the large part of the state, and I can understand where Senator Vickerman might have picked up that there was nothing. It appeared to be nothing in terms of wetlands in the south and western part of the state, and maybe it's because the map was so small it was condensed and that there really worth things that would show. But I would think at some point, if you had it defined enough, ones that have been reestablished through the CREP program and others would certainly show up. And that there might be a contrast of what was before that program went into place and what has happened since to in fact, demonstrate a little credit there when the drain tiles have been crunched.
Well, one of the frustrations that Ms. Bremer was expressing is that for the most part, the data we have is our wetland status, what is remaining, and I think that is remaining our original wetlands? Yeah. Is that what was being?
Pre-settlement?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, those maps that we used, the ones that had lots of wetlands on them were pre-settlement, roughly 1860. The other maps were compiled by the University and the Board of Water and Soil Resources with 1984 data. So even those are rather old, and that's unfortunate. We don't have anything more recent than that.
And I'm sure that,
that would be
Ms. Bremer would love to present the current data.
Yeah.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If folks want to see one of those instances that I cited in Minneapolis that stemmed from those 97 floods, if you're driving along I-35 coming around the curve from the crosstown, so you're going north. You're just south of 60th Street where the Cub Foods is there, just across 60th Street from the Cub Foods. So you'd look to your left, or you'd look to the west side of the highway north of the crosstown. There's a pond down there that you can see from the highway. Well, actually, you can see it if you're going south because you're on the right side then. So you'd look to your right in that case. That used to be a neighborhood of about 40 or 50 homes there. They had, as it turns out, we found out they had been flooded for many, many years, repeated. They had kind of kept it quiet. A lot of people didn't know how extensive the problem was until that year when it was so extreme in so many parts of the city. They kept it quiet because, of course, they were concerned about the reputation of the neighborhood, their ability to sell their homes, the value of the property, et cetera. But it was so extraordinary that, so you look down at that pond, and you can imagine, visualize a whole bunch of homes, 40, 50 homes that had been there just a few years prior.
Mr. Jess, your hand has been
Senator
up for a while.
Mr. Chairman,
please
members.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Tom Jess. Part of the reason why I want to comment is to help educate the members of the committee. If you'll take the time and have your staffers go to the House website and get a number of documents, House information briefs they're called, you can search on wetlands, you can search on drainage, you can search on ditching, and you'll have a whole bunch of articles. I've done it. There's one that also has one that lays out our wetland laws, and it's interesting to see how the state has evolved. Roughly, with regards to the maps that you saw, the 1860 map showed roughly about 10 to 11 million acres of wetlands. Of those wetland acres, 5 million were right away deeded over to the state to encourage agricultural production. So 5 million of those 10 million acres were set to go into production. Many, many lakes, wetland complexes were drained to be able to get that. One good book to read would be the Draining of the Great Oasis. It's put out by the Maury County Historical Society, and it talks about a complex of lakes that was drained in Maury County during right around 1912-1913. Our wetland laws were in place even before the main thrust of drainage took place from 1905 to 1930. In those 25 years, most of the wetland drainage took place in the state. Most of the ditch systems were put in place. So you find that out from that book. And it's very educational. Senator Vickerman was honored a number of years ago by the State Waterfowl Association at what they call the State Waterfowl Symposium. It is, if you want to learn about wetlands in various parts of the state, generally the symposium is held throughout the state. It's been in Grand Rapids. We even went to Eau Claire, Wisconsin to talk about the Mississippi River Complex. This year it's going to be held in the cities at the Fort Snelling Park. So, if you have a chance, it's going to be in April, and you can go to the Waterfowl Association website, and they should have the information on when that symposium is going to be held. But there is a lot of information to help you get acquainted with the subject. And I was hopping around back here, but I just wanted to make that information known to the committee members so that, especially those House information briefs, they're done very well, and they explain some of the problems and topics of what you're going to be discussing with wetlands. So I just wanted to point that out to you.
Senator Parasol?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to comment that some of the soil and water conservation districts are doing excellent work out there. The Dakota Soil and Water, we have streams that go north and streams that drain southward. We have both. And so we're in more than one shed. At the same time, they've done an excellent job from Hastings with the riprap and working on the Vermilion, which crosses many counties, as well as they have several ponds that have come into play now with the local community, because right on the border of the city of Farmington and Castle Rock Township, they have three ponds there, and there are a couple of them north of there, and the sky is loaded with waterfowl. You can hardly drive any time without seeing flocks. And you know, you're distracted from the road by all those flocks of waterfowl moving back and forth, and so. And they're on the ponds all the time. You can just see them from Highway 3. If you pass north and south, you'll see them north of town. You'll see them south of town.
And just
FYI, that used to be cornfields and bean fields after they were not.
FYI, the 2007 Wetland Summit will be this weekend at Normandale Community College, and the focus of that is on discussion around agriculture and 2007 Farm Bill. So we will have more to report after this weekend. Any other discussion? We're not going to have time for the part five of the history of the land, so I think we'll take that up on Monday. Further discussion? Meeting's adjourned.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Senator Sharon.
I was very interested in the presentations today and in this dialogue because of the function of this committee and our need to understand the relationship between the environment and the other goals that we have. But in terms of this background that's being prepared, are you preparing us, this is a freshman question, I suppose, for a dialogue about what some new objectives as it relates to wetland preservation or some new funding sources, or is there an overall goal that is being presented, similar to the renewable energy standards? Is there something that's coming forward that I'm unclear about that we'll be addressing?
I think there's discussion of legislation, and I'm certainly involved in those discussions. But the first thing I want to do is get the issue out there and hear from the members of this committee on what their thoughts are on this issue. And I think today has been helpful in clearing some of the air. I think there are still some concerns out there, and so the value of this hearing is to bring all the ideas of this committee in formulating our proposal.
Mr. Chair, is there in terms of the discussion, for example, on the suggestions that were made today about what might need to be done to help preserve the wetlands, are those requests or those suggestions in relationship to a defined set of goals for wetland preservation, and they're asking for the resources to help them to achieve goals that are already established?
I think that was the idea behind the MCEA's presentation.
Thank you.
Meeting's adjourned.
Was this in our packet?
Part-time thing's always been.